But then, if she weren't so ingifted, she wouldn't be here.
Awesome.
You don't know what you're missing. The wisteria's twisted boughs are dripping with blooms, never mind that it's October in the world outside. But when Marinus reaches up to touch the flowers, her hand passes clean through. The only vivid colors left in the orison now are the dyes in the clothes we came in with. Clothes. I'm nagged by the thought that I've missed something. What about? Clothes? Possessions? What? It was a similarly nagging thought that had tried to warn me before Sally Timms attacked Jonah 9 years ago, but I didn't listen closely enough. If Jonah weren't having trouble maintaining the orison, I'd telegram him to pause it so I could stop and figure out what's bothering me. As we emerge onto the upper lawn, a black and white peacock darting across our path just fades into the air, leaving a dying trail of cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. Luckily, Marinus was distracted by the ginkgo tree looming up far too quickly for our cautious amble.
This is as far as I came yesterday,
I say, and stop. Thousands of fallen leaves fall upwards from the grey lawn all at once and attach themselves to the tree. Marinus is enchanted by the sight, but I feel a queasiness in Bombadil's stomach. This is serious malprojection, not whimsy. Jonah's losing control of the orison.
It's like a dream in here, says Marinus.
My brother telegrams me.
Get her inside. It's collapsing.
Easier said than done.
Let's look inside, I tell our guest. In there? The house itself? Are you sure that's wise?
Yeah, I have Bombadil say.
Why ever not?
An anxious silence is followed by a worried,
why?
I appeal to a force that is stronger than our guest's cowardice.
Look, Doc, I didn't want to raise any false hopes before, but there's a chance of finding Fred Pink alive in there.
I look at the upper windows.
Alive? After 9 years? Are you sure?
Are you inside yet, sister? Telegrams Jonah. Hurry.
There are no certainties when it comes to orisons, Doc,
I reply.
But time ran differently in the Iona orison, and milk and honey was habitable, so I think it's possible. Don't we owe it to Fred Pink to give the place the once-over, at least? It's the clues he left you that brought us here today, after all.
The guilty shrink takes the bait.
Then yes, if there is even a chance of finding him alive, let's go.
Marinus strides over the last lawn towards Slade House, but when she looks back at me, she looks past me, and her eyes go wide.
Bombadil!
I turn around and see the end of the garden is erasing itself.
What is it?
Asks Marinus.
How do we get out?
A curved wall of nothing is uncreating the garden as the orison collapses in on itself. I thought that by finding a guest as voltaically rich as Marinus and bringing her here, my brother, our lacuna, and the operandi were as good as saved. I see now that I may be too late.
Only fog, Doc. No need to get panicky. Fog? But surely, I mean, look at how quickly it's... Orison fog looks like that. Saw it in Iona, too.
I mustn't let Marinus run out into the wall of non-existence like a headless chicken.
I stride on, calmly. Trust me, Doc. Come on. Hey, would I be this laid back if there was anything to worry about?
The steps up to Slade House are mossy and stained. The once proud door is peeling and rotten, and the knocker is chewed by rust and time. I open the door and hustle Marinus inside. Only 30 paces away, the ginkgo tree is being devoured by the shrinking orison. I close the door behind us and telegram Jonah. We're in. We hear a noise like dragged furniture, and my ears pop as the orison molds itself to the outside of the house.
When I look out again through the mullioned window in the door, nothingness stares back. Blankness is a horror. "What was that noise?" whispers Marinus. "Thunder. The weather in here's been neglected for so long, it's all scrambled up. Fog, storms, blazing sunshine'll be next up."
"Oh," says the mighty shrink, uncertainly. "Autumn leaves are strewn over the chessboard tiles in the hallway. Our old Czech housekeeper would be appalled by this version of the Slade House she kept so spick and span in Jonah's and my corporeal days. The coving is festooned with spiderwebs, the doors are hanging off their hinges, and the panelling up the stairs is wormy and flaking."
"What now?" asks the mighty shrink. "Should we search the ground floor, or—"
This time the thunder wallops the walls. They shudder. Marinus touches her ears.
"God, did you feel that?"
"Brother," I telegram, "we're inside. What's wrong?"
"A dying operandi is what's wrong."
Jonah sounds frantic.
"The house is buckling. Get the guest to the lacuna now."
"It's the atmospherics,"
I reassure Marinus.
"Quite normal."
"Call downstairs," I instruct Jonah. Pregnant pause, then,
"What are you talking about?"
"Pretend you're Fred Pink, trapped, and call downstairs." Another pause. Jonah asks,
"What did he sound like?"
"You played him last open day. English, gruff."
"Are you sure it's normal, Bombadil?"
Marinus is afraid.
"There was a barometer in Milk and Honey," I ad-lib. "That—"
We hear something. Marinus holds up a finger and looks up the stairs, whispering.
"I heard someone. Did you?"
I look vague and we listen. Nothing. Mile thick. Nothing. Marinus begins to lower her finger. And then we hear Fred Pink's elderly, shaky voice.
"Hello, is there anyone there? Hello?"
The fearless shrink calls out,
"Mr. Pink, is that you?" Yes, I've had a little fall. Upstairs, please."
"We'll be right with you."
Without a glance, Marinus is gone, climbing two steps at a time. For the first time since the aperture, I feel properly in control. I have Bombadil follow in Marinus's wake, relieved by how the multilingual psychiatrist with an MD, first class, from Columbus State University, is so easily codded by my brother, Crying Wolf. The carpet is threadbare. The dust has formed a light crust, and when we reach the little landing, the grandfather clock is silent, and its face is too scabby to read. Similarly, the portraits of our early guests are leprous with mould, and Marinus, befuddled by the strangest hour of her life, flies past them without a first glance, let alone a second. The shrink in shining armour sees the pale door at the top of the stairs and launches herself up again, stepping over the desiccated body of an owl. As I pass Sally Tim's portrait, I slap her, a gesture as petty as it is pointless. She caused this trouble, or her ghost did. By spiking my brother's throat at the vital second, she stopped us feeding the operandi with her sister Freya's soul and reduced us to psychovoltaic pauperdom, which ends today. I collide with Marinus's back, just a few steps short of the pale door, next to Freya Tim's grime-encrusted portrait, and I hiss,
"Why have you stopped, Doc?"
She's listening to the rumbling silence.
"How do we know these are the right stairs?"
I begin saying,
"Of course they are."
We hear timber splinter in the hallway below, and we hear Jonah as Fred Pink calling through the door above us.
"I'm in here. Hello? Hello? I need a little help. Is anyone there? Please!"
My brother's acting is as hammy as ever, and the volume's too loud,
but Marinus just seizes the beveled doorknob and vanishes. On any other open day, I would assume that the job is done and the guest is safely rendered to our lacuna in the attic, but today I assume nothing. First I telegram, "Do you have her, Jonah?" My answer is a bellow of splitting masonry, glass, and wood as the Orizon's perimeter annihilates the shell of Slade House. Destruction roars up the lower stairs, and Bombadil's feet are rooted to the step as my host's unconscious self and I grapple for control of his adrenaline-crazed nervous system. Through his eyes, I watch the seething front of nothing reach the little landing, erase it and its dead grandfather clock, then surge up towards skinny, tattooed Bombadil. Death. Something orders me. Jump. It's time. But no. The operandi needs both Greer twins, and if I obeyed the impulse, I'd kill Jonah. So I egress with a few seconds' grace after psycho-shoving Bombadil's runty body down the stairs. Thumpity-thumpity-thump. My ex-host yells, brokenly, his sentience returned too late to halt his descent, much less assemble his wits. And then, he's gone. Ski jacket, chilblains, iPhone, internet porn habit, childhood memories, body and all, gone in a non-flash. I, as my soul, rotate and transverse through the pale door.
I emerge in a commendable copy of the private hospital room at the Royal Berkshire Hospital, where I spent a recent week as a patient, taking meticulous notes. True, Marinus is a psychiatrist, and not an A&E mopper-upper. True, she knows North American hospitals better than British ones, but a single anomaly could end in our guest smelling an illusory rat and rejecting the Banjax. And without this anesthetic, the extraction of her soul would be messy and partial. Consequently, Jonah and I evoked the room with a fanatical eye for realism. A wall-mounted TV, a wash basin with a swivel tap, two wipeable chairs, a bedside table, a chipped vase, a door with a linen curtain over its small window, and an easy-to-read clock saying 8:01 with blinds down to suggest PM, not AM. The air is scented with bleach, and the sonic hospital backwash includes the ping of lift doors, the trundle of trolley wheels, and an unanswered phone. Dr. Iris Marinus Fenby lies unconscious, with a drip in her arm and her head in a neck brace. My brother enters, evoked as himself, dressed in a doctor's white coat. He sees my soul. Nora, you're late. I look at Jonah as Jonah, enjoying his enjoyment at moving around again, even if the movement is as illusory as the hospital room. Then I evoke myself as a senior doctor in her 40s, reverting to my own voice. The traffic was murder. Well done, sister. How do I look? Give yourself raccoon eyes and spread that indomitable jaw with some 5 o'clock shadow. Well done yourself. Jonah modifies his face and shows me his profile. Better? Better. How are our bodies doing? Yours is in a state of serene perfection, as ever. Mine is still skewered through the throat with a fox-headed hairpin. The attic walls are safe, but the operandi is a drained and dying husk, sister. I give it 15 minutes. I turn to Marinus. Then let's wake the patient and administer her medicine. Then we'll recharge the operandi and repair your throat, cell by cell. Jonah looks at the unconscious woman with impure thoughts. Will she offer any resistance, sister? She rejected the strawberry in the garden, citing Carl Jung and gut instinct, if you please. But the fruit was the hue of raw liver, and when she wakes up, she won't know if it's May Day, Marrakesh, or Monteverdi. Do you have the Banjax? Jonah evokes a red and white tablet on his palm. Sufficiently generic, would you say? Make it smaller, so she can swallow it without effort. Have a glass of water ready.
deny her any chance to stop and think. Jonah shrinks the pill, tips it onto a dish, and evokes a glass and a bottle of Evian on the bedside table.
Look, when you telegrammed from the alley, I was, not at my best, and...
You've been starved of fresh psycho-voltage for 18 years, and trapped in a traumatized body for 9. I'd be insane by now, not just a trifle insecure.
No, sister, let me finish. What I said was a dying huzzah of what I no longer believe. You were, are, right.
My projected self looks at my brother's projected self. About?
About old dogs, new tricks, not-so-splendid isolation from la voix ombragée, and about a higher purpose. Will that do for now?
Well, this is a U-turn. Have I wandered into an orison?
If you're going to gloat, sister, you can bloody well...
No, I'm not gloating, Jonah. I've been waiting 30 years to hear you say this. We'll go to Mount Shiranui. The west of Japan is heaven in the autumn. Enomoto Sensei wants to meet you. She suggested a dozen ways to improve our operandi. The projected Jonah contemplates an ending and a beginning.
Good. Okay. That's decided then.
I think of my brother and me as fetuses sharing Nellie Greer's womb 116 years ago, and of our birth bodies sharing our lacuna for 8 decades. Strangers are they. A lover is first a you and then a we. But Jonah is one half of I. I focus on the matter at hand before I say anything sentimental. Your throat will hurt like holy hell when I pull the hairpin out, but I'll cauterize the wound and...
Now or never, sister.
Jonah puts his left forefinger on our guest's frontal chakra eye. With his right hand, he glyphs her awake. And Iris Marinus Fenby's pupils dilate in the orison's uncertain light.
Stay still, Iris,
says Jonah.
You've been in an accident, but everything's fine. You're in hospital. You're safe.
She's as feeble and scared as she sounds. Accident?
Black ice on the M4 side of town. Your VW's a write-off. But nobody else was involved, and your injuries don't appear to be that serious. You've been here all day. You're in the Royal Berkshire Hospital.
Marinus swallows and looks dazed.
Who? Yes, I'm Gareth Bell, and this is Dr. Hayes. All quacks together. Iris, to help with your treatment program, we'd like to ask a few diagnostics. Are you up to it, do you think? Oh.
The woozy shrink squints.
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
I take over.
Thanks, Iris. That's great. Firstly, can you tell us if you're in any pain right now?
Marinus checks she can move her hands, then her feet.
No, I just numbness, I guess. My joints ache a little.
Aha. I scribble on my clipboard. The IV's feeding you anti-inflammatories and painkillers.
You sustained some nasty bruising up your left side. Secondly, limb mobility.
You just did that for us. Great.
Who said that doctors make the worst patients? Well, hey, maybe psychiatrists make better ones.
I smile. Great. I'll tick my tribal affiliation box.
Do I have any breakages?
Asks Marinus, trying to sit up.
Whoa, whoa,
says Jonah as Dr. Bell.
Iris, take it easy. The neck brace is just a precaution, don't worry. We haven't x-rayed you on the off chance that you're pregnant, Might you be?
No, definitely not pregnant.
Great, I say. We'll take you up to X-ray in an hour or so. Vision, how many fingers? I hold up four.
Four,
says Marinus. And now, I ask.
None, says Marinus.
No problem there, says Jonah. Though we're a tad anxious about concussion. There's a doozy of a contusion round the back of your noggin. We'll CAT scan you after your trip to X-ray, but what recollections do you have of the accident?
Marinus looks haggard and worried. We sit down on her bed.
You recall being in your car?
Yes, but I remember arriving at my destination.
Okay, Jonah says. Where was this destination?
A passageway, an alley off Westwood Road, on the edge of town. Slade Alley. I'd gone to meet Bombadil.
Bombadil? Says Jonah. Not the green man leprechaun-y one from The Lord of the Rings. What a bizarre alias.
I never read it, but my Bombadil's a conspiracy theorist. I don't know if that's his real name or not. He's a research subject. I'm writing a paper on abduction fantasies. He was in an alley, and there was a door in a wall that wasn't normally there.
Fascinating, I say, looking a little alarmed. But I promise you, Iris, the only place you've been today is the Royal Berkshire Hospital.
You know better than us, Jonah says cheerfully, the tricks a mind will play on itself after a trauma or accident. But look, you've told us what we need. If you'd just take this paracetamol to staunch any minor internal bleeding you may have sustained.
Jonah flips up the bed swivel table and places the pill on a little white dish.
I'll text Viv Singh at Dawkins to say you're conscious and verbal. They've been on tenterhooks all day.
Yes, thanks.
Marinus gazes at the easy-to-swallow pill. My evoked heart in my evoked body beats a little faster. I look back. Jonah puts a glass of Evian water by the dish.
Thank you.
Still bleary, Marinus picks up the pill. I look away. Swallow it, I think. Swallow it whole.
No worries,
says Jonah unworriedly, as if our meta lives aren't dependent on this fickle woman doing as he bids her. Jonah scrolls down his contacts, mumbling,
Viv Singh. Could I just ask a question?
Asks Marinus.
Fire away,
says Jonah, not taking his eyes off his iPhone.
Why, in the 11,011 names of God, would I oblige two parasitic soul slayers by imbibing their poison?
The wall clock stops. The LEDs on the monitors die. A far-off telephone falls silent, and Jonah freezes, with his back to both me and Marinus. I stand and back away, stumbling and sick. My brain insists that Marinus, a guest, cannot know more about us than Jonah and I know about her, that a mortal psychiatrist cannot be lying in an evoked bed in our inner orison, watching us calmly like a committee member at a dull meeting, and yet she does. She can be. She is.
Of all the shortcomings in your operandi,
our guest is saying,
your Banjax is the most antiquated. Truly. An anima abortifacient, so fragile that unless the patient imbibes it of his or her own conscious volition, it fails to work. We haven't seen the Shaded Way deploy such a primitive formula for 50 or 60 years. What were you thinking, Grayers? If you'd only updated it,
You could have injected it into my body just now. Or tried to, anyway.
Sister, Jonah telegrams.
What is she?
Danger, I telegram back. Change. A fight. An ending.
Kill her,
Jonah urges.
Kill her! Now! Both of us!
If we kill her, we lose her soul, I telegram my uncensored thoughts. And if we lose her soul, our operandi dies. It won't last 9 more hours, let alone another 9 years. And if the operandi dies, there's no more lacuna.
And without the lacuna,
Marinus says out loud,
the world's time floods in, shrivels up your birth bodies, and then your soul's off to the dusk, right? 116 years, over and out.
Jonah's appalled face reflects my own. He telegrams,
can this trespassing bitch hear us, sister?
Marinus tuts.
Mr. Grayer, shoddy abuse. Bitch is a stingless insult these days. It hurts like, I don't know, a celery stabbing. And trespassing? You invited me here today to get my soul sucked out. And for accepting your invitation, I'm now a trespasser? Not nice.
With a casual glyph, Marinus revokes the ivy drip and neck brace. We can't conceal our astonishment.
Yes, I know about sub-orizons and orizons. A bubble in a bubble, the attic in the house. It's not a bad copy, but
Evian water?
In an NHS hospital? Don't tell me. That was his genius idea, wasn't it?
The intruder looks at me, but nods towards my brother. I don't answer. Unhurriedly, she gets out of bed, and Jonah and I both take a step back.
You'd know better than to conjure up fancy French mineral water, Miss Grayer, after your top-secret undercover stakeout at Dawkins Hospital. I saw you, studying me, through Viv Singh's eyeballs. I reeled you in, as you reeled me in. A company of reelers. Classy pajamas, but...
She glyphs, and her own clothes reappear.
I'm a creature of sartorial habit.
Jonah has let the sub-orizon half fade to conserve voltage, which is wise. A brute force attack on Marinus, however, which I fear Jonah is planning, would be less wise. I sense she's expecting it.
You have us at a disadvantage, I say. You are? I am who I am, Miss Grayer. Born Iris Fenby, 1980, in Baltimore. Marinus got added later. Hereditary reasons. Long story. My family moved to Toronto. I studied psychiatry, and here we are.
I probe.
But you're telepathic. You glyph.
Know what this is? I float a gentle psychowave her way, which she deflects at the Evian bottle. It tips over, trundles to the edge of the tabletop, but vanishes before falling off.
Look at that, Jonah, I say. Our guest and we are 3 peas in a psychosoteric pod.
Marinus is not amused.
Leave me out of your pod, Miss Grayer. I don't use human beings like disposable gloves. Did you even thank that poor wretch Mark Bombadil before tossing him into the garbage just now?
What a lofty hill of divine compassion you sit on, I needle, I speculate, to care for every one of humanity's mewling, puking, rutting 7 billion.
Ah, you people always say that,
the intruder tells me.
Do we? I say. And how do you know our names?
Therein hangs an hour's tale.
Marinus takes a gadget from her jacket and shows us. I see the word Sony.
One of you, at least, has seen this digital recorder before, and I'm guessing it was Mr. Grayer.
She turns to Jonah, who peers closer.
Yes. See if this jogs your memory.
Marinus presses play, and we hear a woman's confident voice.
Interview with Mr. Fred Pink at the Fox and Hounds Pub, Saturday, 28th October 2006, 7:20 p.m.
It's Freya Timms. Marinus presses stop. It's no great feat to read our faces.
She had a life, says Marinus. A sister she loved.
Her anger is controlled but fierce.
Go on. Name her. Or are you too ashamed?
Jonah looks too appalled to name anyone. So the fool should be. His bragging self as Fred Pink 9 years ago, as he toyed with Freya Timms in My Orison of the Fox and Hounds, spun this Ariadne's thread that led Marinus to the heart of our operandi. And when my brother regains the power of speech, he spends it on the wrong question.
How did you get that?
Marinus stares back at him and looks at me. I meet her gaze with no shame at all.
Freya Timms.
Marinus stares back, then peers through the half-gone blinds over the ghostly windows.
Dark nights in these parts. We're in your attic at Slade House, right?
I don't answer. The intruder returns to Jonah's question.
Your crematorium disposes of bodies well enough, but inorganic matter falls through the cracks. In the old days, it hardly mattered. A button here, a hair clip there. But in this century...
Marinus turns back to us and weighs the recorder in the palm of her hand.
Angels really do fit onto pinheads, and the lives of the multitudes inside a memory stick. We are few, Miss Grayer, but we're well connected. Artifacts like this,
she drops the recorder into her pocket,
have a habit of finding us, sooner or later.
I'm forming a theory. Enomoto Sensei spoke about vigilantes, with a pathological urge to slay fellow atemporals.
Who is this us?
Jonah demands of the intruder.
Why not ask your sister for her view? She gets out more.
I keep my eyes on Marinus. She's from across the schism.
Warm?
Le courant profond, I guess.
The deep stream.
Her hands are free to glyph.
Warmer?
What a stupid guessing game.
You're an horologist. Oh, say it with more venom. Spit out the vile word.
Marinus, like Jonah, has a taste for burlesque irony. Like Jonah, she may trip. Jonah, naturally, hasn't heard of horology with a capital H.
She makes clocks.
Marinus's laugh sounds genuine.
Miss Grayer, I almost understand why you tolerate this plodding clerk, this risible thesp, this dim corgi who fancies himself a wolf. But come, between you and me, is he not a liability? A ball and chain? An aptly named Jonah? Did your Saeed never tell you what he thought of him? A preening fool composed of pigs' afterbirth. His words, I swear. We hunted your former master down in the Atlas Mountains with the aid of Freya's recording. So we must thank your brother for that much, at least. The venerable Saeed begged for mercy. He tried to buy it by telling us more than we had hoped to learn. We showed him the same mercy he'd shown his prey down the decades. No more, no less. And now, Jonah has proven to you what a lethal encumbrance he is.
She breaks off, having brought my simmering brother up to boiling point. Jonah is glyphing up a pyroblast with his bare hands. I telegram, don't, but Jonah's head is roaring, and he can't hear, so I shout it out loud, don't! As the vestiges of the hospital room fall away, revealing the long attic of Slade House. 80 years of metalife end at this forking path. Do I join Jonah's assault against an untested enemy who has goaded us to attack her? Even if our victory would end in voltaic starvation? Or do I forsake Jonah, watch him fry, but keep alive a fetal hope of survival? even as Jonah rashly applies every last volt in his soul to Marinus's incineration, I don't know what to do. Marinus, fast as thought, glyphed a concave mirror field. It quivered under impact. I heard the crackle of lava and saw Marinus's face snap with pain, and for a moment I dared hope that our intruder had underestimated us. But the mirror field held, regained its flat plane, and flung back the refocused blacklight straight at its source. There was no time to glyph or warn or intervene. Jonah Greyer lived for over 42,000 days, but he died in a fractured second, killed by a beginner's trick, albeit a trick deployed by a master. I glimpsed a carbonized Jonah, with melted lips and cheeks, trying in vain to protect his eyes, saw him wither into split briquettes and grainy cinders, and watched a nebula of soot lose its human form and fall to the floorboards, smothering a constant candle. My decision had made itself. I see the glow of the candle through my own birth eyelids. I hear the faintest wheeze and crackle of beeswax boiling in its pond at the wick stem. Time, then, has bled into the lacuna. Our operandi is dead. When I open my eyes, instead of Jonah opening his eyes, I will see grief. Grief and I exchanged words in Ely many years ago after Mother died, poor wretch, coughing her lungs up, telling me to take care of Jonah, to protect him, because I was the sensible one. And for over a century I honored that promise, and protected my brother more assiduously than poor Nellie Greyer meant or dreamed. And during these years, grief was only a face in the crowd. Now, however, grief intends to make up for lost time. I'm under no illusions. Jonah's soul is gone to the dusk. His birth body is an ankle-high soot drift around my feet and the base of the Ninevite candle. The pain grief intends to inflict will be colossal. Yet curiously, for now, just for now, I find myself sitting in the dead wreckage of our operandi, amongst the grainy remnants of my twin brother, able to consider my position with a calm clarity. Perhaps this calm is the silty stillness between the sucked-away sea and the tsunami's roaring, horizon-wide, hill-high arrival. But while it lasts, I'll use it. I let Jonah die his futile death alone, proving, I suppose, that my love of survival is stronger than my love for Jonah. Survival is also an ally against grief. If I buckle now, I won't survive. The killer is here, in our attic. Where else would she be? I heard her a little while ago. She picked herself up, gasped with pain, good, and creaked across the old oak boards towards the candle flame, like a monstrous hobbling moth. She's waiting for me to open my eyes and begin the next round. I'll keep her waiting a little longer. Dark skin in the dark space. She watches me watch her. A hunter watching her cornered quarry. Our optic nerves connecting our souls. Jonah's murderer. Marinus, the horologist, who brought death into our stronghold. Yes, I hate her. But how far short it falls, this petty, neutered verb. Hatred is a thing one hosts. The lust I feel to harm, maim, wreck and kill this woman is less an emotion I hold than what I am now become.
I was expecting you.
She speaks in a funereal hush, to join your brother's assault,
as doubtless was he.
Why didn't you?
The end begins. Because it was an abysmal strategy.
My throat, as usual, is dry as I re-inhabit my own body.
If we lost, we'd...
I look at the soot on my feet, end up like this. I stand, my joints are stiff, and take a few steps back so the candle is equidistant between Marinus and me. Yet, if we won, we'd die when the lacuna collapses and the world's time catches up with our bodies. Typical of Jonah. Even when we were children, he would act rashly and leave me to sift through the wreckage and somehow make things right. This time, I can't. Marinus considers this.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Your condolences disgust me, I say, mildly enough. Grief hurts, yes. Every human you ever fed on had loved ones who suffer now as you do, without even a figure to blame, to hate. But you know the proverb, Miss Grayer, who lives by the sword. Don't quote proverbs. Why didn't you kill me just now? Marinus makes an it's complicated face.
First, cold-blooded murder isn't the deep stream's way.
No. You prefer to goad your enemies into shooting first, so you get to plead self-defense. The hypocrite doesn't deny it.
Second, I wanted to ask you if you'd kindly open this inner aperture.
She indicates the tall mirror.
And let me out.
So she's neither all-doing nor all-knowing. I don't tell her that even I can't open the aperture now the operandi is dead. I don't even confirm that the aperture is the mirror, in case she's merely guessing. I just think of Marinus dying when the air in the attic runs out. A satisfying image. I tell her, never.
It was a long shot,
Marinus admits.
But it would have been more elegant than Plan B, which is also a long shot.
She steps towards the candle and reaches into a thigh pocket. I marshal my voltage for a defense. Instead of a weapon, however, she produces a smartphone.
The nearest network is 60 years in the future, I tell her, and the aperture won't relay phone signals to the real world, so sorry.
Her dark face glows in the smartphone's cold light.
Like I said, it's a long shot.
She points her device at the aperture. Stares, waits, checks the screen, frowns, waits, waits, steps around the candle and the soot drift to crouch by the aperture and examine the surface of the mirror, waits, presses her ear against it, waits, and finally gives up with a sigh.
Too long a shot, it would appear.
She puts away her smartphone.
I stashed half a kilo of plastic explosive in the shrubbery by the outer aperture when you, as Bombadil, weren't looking. My canvas bag. You felt something was amiss as we walked beneath the wisteria, I believe, so I distracted you. I hoped the explosion would blow open this aperture from the other side, but either the phone signal didn't reach the detonator, or your operandi is too solidly built.
I'm sorry for your loss, I enjoy saying. Might there be a Plan C, or is Dr. Iris Marinus Fenby going to die today?
Traditionally, we'd stage another climactic battle between good and evil. We'd never agree which of us is which, however, and the only prize on offer is a slower death by oxygen starvation. Shall we forego tradition?
This false levity is repugnant. Death, for you, is just a short break, I understand. She steps back, around the candle, and sits where our guests are, were, usually positioned, opposite the aperture.
It's more troublesome than that, but we do come back, yes. Was Enomoto or the Saeed your principal informant on the deep stream?
Both. Both masters knew of you. Why?
I met Enomoto's grandfather in a former life, a murderous demon of a man. You would have liked him.
You deny us the privileges you enjoy. My voice sounds chipped and cracked. It's this thirst.
You murder for immortality,
states Marinus.
We are sentenced to it.
Sentenced, you say, as if you'd willingly swap your meta-life for a bone clock snatched, wasted, tawdry handful of decades. I feel unaccountably tired. Suppressing my grief over Jonah's murder must be wearing me out. I sit down, a foot or so back from my usual place.
Why do you horologists conduct this...
The word's gone. It's Arabic. It's used in English these days, too.
This jihad against us. We serve the sanctity of life, Miss Grayer. Not our own lives, but other people's. The knowledge that those future innocents whom you would have killed to fuel your addiction to longevity, people as guiltless as the Tim sisters, as Gordon Edmonds, as the bishops, will now survive. That's our higher purpose. What's a meta-life without a mission? It's mere feeding.
What bishops?
All we did,
my voice sounds too wavery,
was seek survival. No more than any sane, healthy animal. No,
Marinus scrunches up her face.
Please, no. I've heard it so often. Humanity is hardwired for survival. Might is right is nature's way. We only harvest a few. Again and again, down the years, same old, same old.
Pain is growing in my hips and knees, a pain I've never known. I wonder if Marinus is responsible. Where's Jonah got to?
From such an array of vultures,
the woman's saying, and I wish she'd speak up.
From feudal lords to slave traders to oligarchs to neocons to predators like you. All of you strangle your consciences, and ethically, you strike yourselves dumb.
The pain has spread to my left wrist. I examine it, and if I could, I'd drop it, horrified. My skin is sagging like a grotesque, ill-fitting sleeve. My palm, my fingers are old. A repulsive illusion, surely, of Marinus's creation. I peer forward, with unseemly effort, to look into the aperture. A white-haired witch stares back, aghast.
The explosion didn't smash the aperture,
says the black woman.
But it did make a crack. Across the middle. There. See?
She crouches next to me and runs her finger along a thick line.
There. The world's leaking in, Miss Grayer. I'm sorry. You're aging at perhaps a decade every 15 seconds.
She's speaking English, but what's she talking about?
Who are you?
The woman stares at me, which is very rude. Don't Africans teach their children manners?
I am Mercy, Miss Grayer.
Well then, Mercy, get me. I know his name. I know his name. But his name doesn't know me.
My brother, this instant, he'll sort it all out. I'm sorry,
says Mercy.
Your mind's decaying.
She rises to her feet and picks up our... what's it called? The thing the candle sits in.
She's going to steal it. Put that back!
I try to stop her, but my feet just twitch uselessly in a pile of dirt. This place is filthy. Where's the housekeeper? Why is this African holding up our candlestick? That's the word. Candlestick. We've had it in the family for generations. It's 3,000 years old. It's older than Jesus. It's from Nineveh. I call out, Bring me Jonah this instant.
The African lifts it up like a thing and swings its heavy base into the mirror. Daylight floods and snowflakes swarm through the splintered plane of the aperture, covering the floorboards, scurrying around the darkest recesses of the attic, like inquisitive schoolchildren. My body has shriveled up around me, like a punctured and bony balloon. Untied, unzipped, unstrapped from its senility-riddled brain, my soul floats free. Marinus, without a backwards glance, steps through the aperture, even as the attic fades away into a wintry sky, above an anonymous town. It's over. Without its birth body anchoring it to the world, the soul of Nora Greer is dissolving. Momentarily it hovers in the mid-air space once occupied by the attic of Slade House. Was that my life? Was that all? There was supposed to be more. Many, many decades more. My cunning had earned it. Look below. Roofs, cars, other lives, and a woman putting on a green beret, leaving the scene via an alley, with a stolen candlestick still in her hand. There is no farewell in the busy air, no hymn, no message, only snow, 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 and the inexorable pull of the dusk. Not yet. Not yet. Dusk pulls. But damn the dusk. Damn Marinus. I'll pull harder. She killed my brother, and now she's walking free. Let grief pull with me. Let hatred strengthen my sinews. My stock of seconds may be meager, but if there's a way to avenge hot-headed Jonah, my precious twin, my truest other half, I'll find that way, however faint the traces. Brick chimneys, slate roofs, thin, narrow gardens with sheds, kennels and compost heaps. Where might a vengeful soul find refuge? A new birth body. Who can I see? A brother and sister at play in the snow. They're old. They're already too interwoven with their own souls. Another boy jumps on a trampoline. He's even older. Of no use. A magpie lands on a garden shed with a croak and a tinny thump. But a human soul cannot inhabit an animal's brain. A garden away, a back door opens, and a woman in a woolen hat steps out holding a bowl of peelings.
No snowballing your sister, Adib. Build a snowman. Something gentle.
She's pregnant. It shows, even from 30 feet up. And now I see it all. I see the beauty of the pattern. The woman is not here by chance. Her appearance is caused by the script. Dusk hauls me to itself, but now I perceive an alternative fate. I resist. My newborn mission makes me strong, and my mission is this. One day, however distant, I will whisper into Marinus's ear. You killed my brother, Jonah Greer. And I kill you, now and for all time. I transverse down with the ponderous snow, the living snow, the eternal snow. Undetected, I pass through the mother's coat, her underclothes, her skin, her uterus wall, and I'm home again, my new, warm home, my anchorage, immune to the dusk. And safe in the brain of a fetal boy. This miniature, drowsing, curled up, dreaming, thumb-sucking astronaut. This is Tanya Rodriguez. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Slade House by David Mitchell, produced by Heavy Entertainment. Text copyright David Mitchell, 2015. Production copyright Hodder and Stoughton, 2015. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.